Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Happening now, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is once again pushing for votes on the Biden agenda, perhaps within hours. The timing up in the air as Democrats clash over the bills and the direction of the party after stinging election results. I'll speak with a key player in all of this, the top House progressive representative Pramila Jayapal. Also tonight, breaking news in the January 6th investigation. A former Trump Justice Department official who pushed the big lie is now expected to testify tomorrow. This is former President Trump's fight to keep secrets from the Select Committee is facing skepticism from a federal judge. And the Biden administration sets a deadline for over 100 million workers to comply with the new COVID vaccine mandate. I'll ask the Labor Secretary, Marty Walsh, about the potential impact on businesses and the economy. Welcome to our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room. We begin with the newest attempt by Democrats to pass President Biden's agenda after Tuesday's election results turned up the political heat. Let's go straight to our chief White House correspondent, Caitlin Collins. Caitlin, Democrats are eager to move forward, but they don't agree on the path to take. So where do things stand tonight?
Well, we're really still waiting to see, because we know House Speaker Pelosi was telling her caucus behind closed doors earlier this morning she wanted to have a vote by tonight. But that is looking less and less likely, as they are very much still hunting for those votes, with moderate Democrats saying they want to see the final financial impact of this bill before they are ready to say yes.
Still reeling from a major election night setback, Democrats are making an urgent push to get President Biden's agenda over the finish line.
The more results we can produce in a way that is people understand in their lives, the better it is.
Aiming to show voters that Democrats can deliver, party leaders could move within hours to vote on the $1.75 trillion plan to expand the social safety net and fight climate change.
We're going to pass both bills, but in order to do so, we have to have votes for both bills, and that's where we are.
Moderate House Democrats say they want to see the true cost of the legislation before committing to a vote.
Those are the kind of things that we think are really important we make sure we go through.
The final scope of the bill also remains to be seen after House Democrats added 4 weeks of paid leave back into the proposal despite opposition from Senator Joe Manchin.
Let's get it done. That's exactly what I'm saying. Let's get it done in regular order through the process.
I disagree. I think that this is appropriate for this legislation. It fits very comfortably with child care, health care, home care.
After a series of bruising losses on election night, the Democratic Party is divided over the best path forward.
We don't have the numbers that FDR had or that Lyndon Baines Johnson had in order to get some major legislation done. We don't have those.
One House Democrat facing re-election in Virginia, Abigail Spanberger, issuing a warning about Biden's sweeping agenda, telling the New York Times, nobody elected him to be FDR. They elected him to be normal and stop the chaos. The White House pushing back.
This is not too much. This is what needs to happen, and it should have happened decades ago.
Republicans warning the decline in the president's approval ratings will have a drag on Democrats in the 2022 midterms.
If you're a Democrat and President Biden won your seat by 16 points, you're in a competitive race next year. You are no longer safe.
Now, Wolf, when it comes to whether or not they are having these votes tonight, it remains to be seen, because there are still several outstanding issues that they have not really ironed out the details on. When it comes to immigration, when it comes to negotiating drug pricing, local tax deductions, all of these are still things that are critical to actually getting that final vote to happen. And so we are waiting to see what Democrats are going to do tonight, though we did hear from Congresswoman Debbie Dingell earlier on CNN, who said Democrats are not leaving town until they have a movement on both of these bills, Wolf.
All right, Caitlin, I want you to stay with us. I also want to bring in our congressional correspondent, Jessica Dean, and our chief national affairs correspondent, Jeff Zeleny, as well. Jessica, Democrats have promised votes before, only to back down. It's happened a few times already. So what are you hearing right now from lawmakers up on Capitol Hill?
Well, we just heard a few moments ago from the Democratic leadership. We saw Steny Hoyer go to the floor and say they are breaking for dinner. So there was kind of a flurry of activity. Everyone exited the House floor. They're going to take a break for dinner. And he said for members to stand by, that there could be a vote later tonight, that they will give them 1 hour's notice. So right after that, we saw House Speaker Nancy Pelosi walk right by our camera here just a few moments ago. She went right back into her office where they continue to try to finalize this deal. As Caitlin noted, Wolf, there are still some outstanding issues over here, including immigration, drug price negotiations, and state and local tax deductions that they are still trying to work out. And they don't want to bring this to the floor until they have the votes, Wolf. And currently, there's no exact plan to bring it to the floor, just that they might. So that pretty much tells you everything you need to know in terms of where we are at this moment. And that is, we just aren't sure if there will be a vote on this tonight.
And they want to vote on the $1.75 trillion social spending bill before the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that already passed the Senate. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. So they want to do Build Back Better first and then do the bipartisan infrastructure bill tomorrow. Now, Nancy Pelosi had said earlier today she hoped to do Build Back Better today, do the infrastructure bill tomorrow. Whether or not that remains to be seen, we just don't know. And as you all have followed and we have reported, there was a lot of back and forth about which comes first and are they tied together. They've settled on Build Back Better first and then the bipartisan infrastructure bill. The question remains, when those votes will happen.
You know, Jeff, Democrats are still arguing with what's in and what's out of this bigger spending plan. Moderates and progressives are each taking different lessons from the Democrats' loss in Virginia, aren't they?
They absolutely are, Wolf. I mean, there is a greater sense of urgency since the loss in Virginia. The Democratic former Virginia governor, of course, Terry McAuliffe, believes he lost, and one of the reasons, because the Democrats in Congress simply have been divided. There simply has not been any action. So, yes, there's a bit more urgency. But as Jessica was just pointing out there, I mean, this is hardly a new concept. You know, this has been underway here for weeks and negotiations have been going on for months. So, you know, it is it's really really typifying this whole issue here, that the president and Democratic leaders have just simply been unable to corral their leadership. We do expect a vote. It certainly looks like it's getting closer than it has before. But, boy, this is not exactly how to run a railroad. And this is one of the very reasons that voters simply, you know, think that Democrats don't necessarily have their act together. So we'll see if they get this done. We'll see how the legislation actually looks. But you know, at this point, there is a sense of urgency, but really, why should there be urgency now? I mean, they've gone to this point, so get it right, get it done. We'll actually see what happens. It's one of those open-ended questions here, when or if it will get done tonight or in the coming days.
Yeah, let's not forget how tight the Democratic majority
they need everyone.
In the House is. They certainly do. 221
right.
Democrats in the House, 213 Republicans, one vacant seat. They can't afford to lose three or four Democrats because the Republicans presumably aren't going to vote for this, for the broader social spending
right.
bill. They will vote for the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which is going to, which is clearly going to pass the House and then go to the president for his signature. Caitlin, as you reported, moderate Democrat Abigail Spanberger says nobody elected President Biden to be FDR. But hasn't Biden's whole goal been to pass this truly transformational legislation and do it through reconciliation, a simple majority, 50 votes plus the vice president?
Well, I'm not sure if during the campaign the president was counting on using reconciliation to do it. That became clear, obviously, once he took office, how Republicans were completely opposed to this agenda that the president is trying to get through. But that is kind of the White House pushback to those comments and that criticism from not only Abigail Spanberger, but from other Democrats who were saying that this is causing a drag on what's happening, especially in these races that you saw Tuesday night. And the White House is saying this is something that the president has said he was running on since he was a candidate. He has made clear that this is the agenda he was going to pursue. He wanted to get these things done. Of course, several of his key campaign promises are not actually ending up in this bill as it stands right now. But that is the pushback from the White House. Though, of course, we should note the climate here is what's under consideration by these Democrats, especially ones like Abigail Spanberger, who are going to be up for re-election next year, who are concerned about things that are affecting Americans now that were not necessarily a major issue in their lives a year ago, including, of course, inflation, the supply chain issues, these shortages that you're seeing all across the nation that the White House is also talking about. But Democrats are saying maybe we should be focusing more on this since it's a chief concern for these voters and less on the other.
You know, Jeff, you heard the House Speaker say she was very unhappy, her words, very unhappy, that they didn't pass the infrastructure bill last week. Do Democrats realize it's way past time to just get this done? They could have passed it in August when it passed the Senate with 69 votes, 19 Republicans, all 50 Democrats voted for it. They could have passed it in August when it first came to the House, but they've been waiting and waiting and waiting.
Without a doubt, and this really has underscored this divide deeply within the Democratic Party, progressives believed their only hope to getting the larger package was to hold off on the infrastructure. So what that showed was there's no trust. There's no trust between the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the moderate wing and the White House. So in doing so, it not only probably affected the Virginia governor's race, but it certainly has affected President Biden's overall approval rating, which now is at the lowest of any president since former president, his predecessor, Donald Trump. So this certainly is something that, look, there's plenty of blame to go around on both sides, but certainly there could have been a vote in August, but progressives simply didn't trust the rest of their party to come along and do this. But now, as Caitlin said, some of the very principles that the president campaigned on, like free community college, other matters, are simply not in this bill. So I was speaking with one senior Democrat this morning who said, look, the president has decided to get engaged in this legislative process. So why not simply tell these members to vote? I need to vote on it right now. He's walked up to that line and asked them for their support. He's been on the Hill a couple times, but never said we need to vote at this moment. So that is what some of them are waiting for. The White House, of course, wary to jump into all this, but it simply does not have a good look. And we're seeing the effects of this in the country.
Yeah, it's having an enormous impact indeed. All right, guys. Thank you very much. Just ahead, Democrats clearly clashing over President Biden's sweeping spending bills as the Speaker Nancy Pelosi urgently pushes for a vote. We're going to get the very latest on the state of play from the top House progressive, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. She's standing by live. We will discuss when we come back. All political eyes are up on Capitol Hill tonight, where House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is pushing lawmakers to vote on President Biden's sweeping spending plans as soon as possible, with Tuesday's stinging Democratic election losses fueling her sense of urgency. Let's get the very latest with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Congresswoman, thank you so much for joining us. Speaker Pelosi wants a vote on this bigger spending bill tonight, the infrastructure bill tomorrow, the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Do Democrats have the votes in the House?
Well, Wolf, it's good to see you. We are working on that right now. The Speaker has been working very hard on that. Each of us that lead different parts of the Democratic caucus have been working very hard on that. I will tell you that progressives are in the same place that we've been for a couple of days. We are ready to vote both bills through. Our friends in some of the other parts of the caucus are getting the information they need to become comfortable with everything that is in the bill, and we hope to be able to get that very quickly.
Why not pass the infrastructure bill that passed the Senate overwhelmingly, 69 votes? Why not pass that tonight, send it to the president, to his desk, let it be signed into law, and then deal with the more complicated $1.75 trillion social spending bill?
Well, actually, Wolf, almost everybody is on board within the Democratic caucus with both bills. So we're just waiting for a handful, and I think we will get that handful, and then we will pass both bills through the House.
But you definitely want the larger bill, the more controversial spending bill, to go first. Is that right?
Well, we just want that bill to be finished, and we want to pass both bills through the House because we don't want any more delay on the things that are actually going to affect people's lives. And I think this election on Tuesday showed us how seriously we have to take these issues, these pocketbook issues. And the reality is the Build Back Better Act is going to reduce costs for poor families and working families. It's going to help with universal child care, universal pre-K, cutting the cost of prescription drugs, cutting the cost of housing, making housing affordable, and of course, taking on climate change and taking care of immigrants who have been holding up this country. So I think that's why we're not willing to leave anybody behind. That's why we want to pass both bills together, which of course, as you know, Wolf, has been our position for months, and we are now ready to pass both bills through.
But one of the problems with the bigger bill was underscored, the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, put paid family leave, for example, back into the larger spending bill. That's something, for example, that moderate Senator Joe Manchin opposes. You need all 50 Democrats in the Senate to pass it if it's going to go from the House to the Senate. If that provision is removed in the Senate, will you still vote for the bill when it's sent back to the House?
Well, look, it broke our hearts when paid family leave was not in the Biden framework that was unveiled last Thursday. And we had, of course, pushed extremely hard for that. We did endorse the framework as it was laid out, and we are willing to vote for this bill, and let's push paid family leave and see if we can get it. But we understand where Senator Manchin is, and it's not where the rest of us are, but at the end of the day, if we can't get that, that was the Speaker's decision. I applaud it to put paid family leave back in, and of course, we're very supportive of that. So I don't think that's the issue for the handful of people that are left. I think they really are just getting comfortable with what's in it, and I think they're getting that information, and hopefully we'll be able to pass it through very quickly.
What I found was interesting, that Democratic Congresswoman Kathleen Rice, a woman you know, rejects your takeaway from the Virginia election results. She said this, she said, "I don't understand some of my more progressive colleagues saying that what we need to do is to get both of these bills done and shove even more progressive stuff in. What we're talking about is not resonating with voters." How do you respond to her?
Well, look, I don't like to call anybody out, but what I will just say is that if you look at each of the pieces of these of this bill, they are incredibly popular. Each piece is incredibly popular with voters. And don't forget, these aren't crazy progressive ideas that are out of the frame of what the president actually came to Capitol Hill and we all stood up and applauded him for. This is the president's agenda. It's what we ran on, and it will reduce costs for poor families and working families, middle-class families across the country. It will take on climate change. It will give people the kind of security, economic security, that I think they are desperately needing, because we're still in the throes of the worst recession, worst pandemic that we've had, something that we've been in for 2 years and 2.5 years now. And so it's really important that we answer the hurt that people have. And these provisions are universally popular. And again, this is what the president and all Democrats, progressive, conservative, whatever you want to call people, all of us ran on these proposals.
There's obviously still disagreement. We're going to get, we'll find out in the next day or so what happens. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, you got your hands full up there on Capitol Hill. Thanks for taking a few moments and joining us.
Thank you, Wolf.
Coming up, we're learning a key witness in the January 6th investigation is now expected to face the Select Committee in a matter of hours. We've got new information. We'll update you when we come back. We just learned that a key witness in the January 6th investigation is now expected to testify before the Select Committee tomorrow. The former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark, who pushed former President Trump's big lie, he's expected to show up. And this comes on the heels of a very high-stakes hearing on Trump's efforts to keep secrets from the Select Committee. Our senior legal affairs correspondent Paula Reed reports.
Okay.
In a high-stakes court hearing in Washington, Trump lawyers arguing the former president should be able to keep more than 700 pages of his White House records secret from lawmakers investigating the January 6th riot.
We fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
But federal judge Tanya Chutkan at times appeared deeply skeptical about Trump's case. Are you really saying that the president's notes, talking points, telephone conversations on January 6th have no relation to the matter on which Congress is considering legislation? The January 6th riot happened in the Capitol. That is literally Congress's house. The House Select Committee insists these records are essential to its investigation.
We want to document a complete record of everything that was going on, really minute by minute, during the day of the insurrection.
President Biden, who as the sitting president has the power to withhold previous administration's documents, so far has declined to do so, pointing to the extraordinary circumstances of January 6th.
The former president's actions represented a unique and existential threat to our democracy that we don't feel can be swept under the rug.
Trump has asked the federal court to block the committee's requests, arguing that the January 6th investigation is illegitimate and that even as a former president, he should get control over access to his records. The committee wants to see documents from top White House advisors, handwritten notes about January 6th, Trump's daily schedule, White House visitor logs, and call records. Trump's lawyer, Justin Clark, arguing the requests are overly broad and that failure to block them would open up the door for the partisanship of document requests and blowing a hole in executive privilege that should concern everybody. While the judge asked Clark to dial down the rhetoric a bit, she challenged lawyers for the House committee on the breadth of the documents requested, saying, some of these requests seem very narrowly tailored, but some are alarmingly broad, and there has to be some limit.
This is a truly historic case with significant implications for the presidency, and it's likely whatever decision the judge makes will be appealed. Now, right now, these documents are scheduled to be handed over next Friday, and any delay could really hinder the committee's investigation. But Wolf, the chairman of the committee, says he has signed about 20 additional subpoenas, and those could go out as soon as tomorrow.
Yeah, this is beginning to move potentially very rapidly. Paula, thank you very much. Paula Reed reporting for us. Let's get some analysis. Joining us, our chief legal analyst, Jeffrey Toobin. He's the author of the book, True Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. Also with us, our senior legal analyst, former U.S. attorney, Preet Bharara. This former Justice Department official, Jeffrey Clark, is set to appear before the Select Committee tomorrow behind closed doors. But his testimony has been a moving target over the past couple of weeks, hasn't it?
Yes. He changed lawyers. He delayed his initial appearance. We'll see if he actually shows up tomorrow. But if he does, one of the most important questions that he will be asked is, who were you dealing with at the White House? Who knew that you were engaged in this activity? Who told you to do it? It's not just about what he thinks about what happened. It's what his relationships were and what his conversations and potentially documents were related to. What were they with other people, especially at the White House?
You know, Preet, you heard a little of what the judge had to say today in this hearing over Trump White House documents. How do you interpret that?
Well, the key takeaway from that is that this judge, and I think most reasonable judges would have the same view, she does not believe in the vast, overbroad assertions of executive privilege because it is not based on law. It's not based on precedent. I think she has the view, and she stated it very sort of plainly at the hearing at various junctures, that she thinks the argument is overstated. The other thing that I think is clear from her comments is she doesn't think that every single thing that's being asked for by the 1-6 committee is fair game. Remember, there are two things going on here. There's what happened on January 6th and the planning of that event that led to the insurrection on 1-6. And then the committee's view, it seems, and the Democratic view at least, is that all of that is a culmination of things that were going on for many, many, many months, all part of the big lie in the plan to challenge the election. But in her view, the further back you go in time, there's more of a question about whether or not documents from 8, 9, 10 months earlier are relevant and appropriate to be produced.
You know, Preet, on a different issue, the Justice Department here in Washington has just filed a lawsuit against the state of Texas over its new voting restrictions. I spoke earlier today to former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. Watch what he told me about this wave of restrictive new laws.
There's no basis for the implementation of these measures. It's all based on the notion, the false notion, that somehow, some way, there has been voter fraud and that these measures need to be put in place to fight that fraud. The fraud is non-existent. These measures are put in place to retard the ability of people who are not Republicans, who are not conservatives, to retard their ability to get to the polls.
You expect the Justice Department to prevail, Preet, in this case?
I think it's too early to tell. I would like to associate myself with the comments of the former attorney general with whom I served in the Justice Department. I think it's on good footing. There's also the question of, you know, it's a very conservative court, the district courts in Texas, within the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So I think we'll see. I think the other takeaway is, before we get to the issue of whether or not they'll prevail, which will take some time, is that the Justice Department is being very aggressive with respect to not only voting rights, but also rights of reproductive rights. They've also filed suit with respect to that law, SB 8, in Texas. So you have a very active Justice Department in its Civil Rights Division, and we'll see what happens.
All right. That's certainly true. The problem is, especially when it comes to voting rights, even before all three Trump justices were seated, the Roberts Court has restricted voting rights, and I think this case has an uphill battle.
We shall see. All right, Jeffrey Preet, guys, thank you very much. And stay with CNN for a special report, Trumping Democracy, an American Coup, anchored by our Jake Tapper. It premieres tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Eastern, only here on CNN. Just ahead, the Biden administration now sets a deadline for millions of U.S. workers to get vaccinated against COVID-19. The Biden administration has set a January 4th deadline for millions of U.S. workers to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19, including certain healthcare workers, federal contractors, and people who work for companies with 100 or more employees. Joining us now to talk about this, the Labor Secretary, Marty Walsh. Mr. Secretary, thanks so much for joining us. You're getting some pushback right now. The National Retail Federation, and I'm quoting now, calls it burdensome and unnecessary. The Associated Builders and Contractors, a trade group, says it's likely to increase costs for the American public. How do you respond to this?
Well, it's certainly not going to increase costs to the American public. And what this standard is, it's a process of getting people vaccinated. And if people choose not to get vaccinated, they get tested. It's that simple. And we want to make sure that we keep American workers safe in the workplaces. Some of the folks that aren't coming back to work are still in fear of the virus. And what we want to do is get as many people vaccinated and people that choose not to get vaccinated, making sure we know that people are safe and not bringing the coronavirus into the workplace.
As you know, OSHA says, and I'm being specific now, that they'll fine companies $14,000 per violation. People don't do what they're supposed to be doing, according to this new mandate. They say the mandate covers 80 million workers in the U.S. So how would OSHA actually enforce this?
OSHA's done this for over 50 years, so they certainly have the enforcement mechanism down. But I'm not looking. I've got that question a lot today. I'm not looking at the negative side of this. I'm looking at the positive side. We've seen many companies in America that have brought in a mandate. They have about 85 to 90% of their employees getting vaccinated already. And what we want to do is just encourage people to get vaccinated. If they choose not to get vaccinated, we're asking, they're going to get tested. And then in the workplace, when they're around, other people are going to wear a mask. This is not a mandate. It really is about, how do we get the American workforce safe? President Biden announced this in September, asked OSHA to come back with a standard. We came back with a standard today, and that's what we're going to move forward on.
As you know, some states are already threatening to sue to prevent you guys from doing this. How confident are you that you have the legal status to go ahead and get this done?
Yeah, we're confident in this. And to be honest with you, I was thinking backstage before I came out with you, the first time I was on with you was when I was mayor of Boston, and we were talking about the coronavirus and the amount of people that died in Boston that particular day and the amount of people that got infected that particular day. From that day till today, we have 745,000 Americans that have lost their life. People are still getting testing positive. What we want to do is get to the other side of this virus. This is one step in moving there, making sure we have safety in the workplace and encouraging people to get vaccinated. And if they choose not to, test.
Yeah, just to be precise, the Johns Hopkins University now says more than 750,000 Americans have died from COVID-19 over the past, nearly 2 years right now. More Americans have died from COVID than in any other country in the world.
And that's a pretty big number. It's a daunting number when you think about it. And I was down at the Washington Monument a couple weeks ago, and we saw the white flags. And when you look at the white flag and see the amount of loss of life that people, families in this country have faced due to COVID-19, it's devastating for a lot of families. And what we want to do is prevent other deaths. And how do we do it? Making sure that workplaces are safe.
On a political issue, you're the former mayor of Boston. You were mayor of Boston for 7 years. Michelle Wu has just become the first woman, first person of color to become mayor of Boston. What do you think?
I work with Michelle with the mayor-elect when she was a city councilor in Boston. You know, it's a great day for Boston. It's exciting. It was a good race. Anissa Arsabi George and Michelle had a very spirited race for mayor. And Michelle ran a brilliant campaign. And I talked to her yesterday. and I offered my support to her. The Boston's one of the greatest cities. Well, I better fix that. Boston's the greatest city in the world. I got myself in trouble with Labor Secretary, but it is, and it's a great city to be mayor of, and I wish Michelle all the luck in the world.
You got a football team over there, as I've heard, as well.
And we have a quarterback now again.
Yeah. All right, thanks very much for joining
Thank you.
Appreciate it. The Labor Secretary, Marty Walsh. Coming up, a nearly all-white jury chosen to decide the racially charged murder trial of the three white men accused of killing black jogger Ahmaud Arbery. This just into the Situation Room. The judge in the trial of three white men charged in the killing of African-American jogger Ahmaud Arbery has announced that opening statements will begin tomorrow. CNN's Martin Savage reports there's controversy over the jury that's been selected to hear the case.
Outside the courthouse in Brunswick, Georgia, reaction to the overwhelmingly white jury ranges from disappointment to outrage.
No justice! No
peace! 11 white jurors and one African-American will decide the fate of the three white men accused of killing the 25-year-old black man Ahmaud Arbery while he was out jogging. The jury, chosen at the end of a grueling 2.5-week selection process that had originally summoned 1,000 residents drawn from a county where a quarter of the population is black.
We're very pleased that we have been able to select now 16 members of this community.
The revelation immediately drawing a motion from the prosecution suggesting the defense's decision to remove 8 African Americans from jury consideration was based solely on race.
African American jurors made up 1/4 of the jury panel. But the actual jury that was selected has only one African American male on it.
Defense attorneys vehemently denied that, arguing black potential jurors were removed because they didn't believe they'd be impartial. The judge, at first, seeming to side with the prosecution.
This court has found that there appears to be intentional discrimination.
But ultimately ruling based on the defense's statements, the case could go forward with the selected jurors.
They've been able to explain to the court why, separate from race, those individuals were in fact struck from the panel.
The case has been racially charged from the start, with the three white men accused of pursuing and killing a young black man jogging through their neighborhood in 2020, suspecting that he had committed a crime. An armed Gregory McMichael and his son Travis chased an unarmed 25-year-old Arbery in a truck, eventually confronting him. In the resulting struggle, prosecutors say Travis McMichael shot Arbery 3 times with a shotgun. Their neighbor, William Bryan, authorities say, joining the pursuit, recording the incident on his cell phone. It wasn't until 2 months after the shooting, when the video was made public, that the men were arrested.
All three men have entered pleas of not guilty, but there is late-breaking news for you, Wolf, and it concerns that jury. Just as the court was going into recess this evening, the judge announced that one of the jurors has been struck. The reason the juror says, or the judge says, the juror was removed was due to health reasons. And he stated that now alternate number one has joined the 12-member panel. Many were concerned, well, who is this juror that's been struck? The judge would only identify that person as a white female and that she has been replaced with a white female. But what this means now, even before testimony begins, the number of alternates that were 4 are down to 3 in a time of COVID. Wolf?
All right, Martin Savage reporting for us. A good report. Thank you very much. Let's dig deeper right now. CNN legal analyst, criminal defense attorney Joey Jackson is joining us. Joey, what's your reaction to the racial makeup of this jury?
I think it's problematic. I think it's certainly there are issues with respect to who's on that jury when you look at the demographics of the community. 70% white, 25 or 27% African-American, and you have one of the 12 jurors, right? 11 being white. And so I think that's a major concern, and I think it leads to the distrust that people hold for the system, particularly when you have the judge, Wolf, saying it appears there's intentional discrimination, but let's start the trial anyway and not giving any real remedy to the defense to remedy that situation.
What exactly does the law, Joey, say about racial discrimination during the jury selection process?
It says it's not permitted. And usually what happens is that you have the prosecution that's attempting to exclude jurors in order to gain a conviction. Here you have the reverse, which is called a reverse Batson challenge, where you have the defense, which seems to be or appears to have done, right, a systematic preclusion, exclusion of African-Americans. So the law says you can exclude a juror for any reason or no reason, as long as, Wolf, it's not discriminatory. You have a judge here uttering the words, it appears intentional discrimination, but failing to take a specific step in order to remedy that, and that's really troubling.
Could the selection, the makeup of this jury, potentially be the basis for some sort of appeal?
It cannot, and I'll tell you why. What happens is that, generally speaking, the appeal is left to the defense following a conviction. In the event, as in this instance, if the jury assists in gaining an acquittal, acquittals cannot be appealed, convictions can. And so it inures to the benefit of the defense here to the extent that they have, apparently, the defendants, the jury they want. And so really, what would they be appealing, right? If there's an acquittal, they got what they want. Prosecution can't appeal it. The only way you can appeal is if someone is convicted.
Our legal analyst, Joey Jackson, helping us as he always does. Thank you very much. Just ahead, we're going to pull back the curtain on Senator Joe Manchin and the enormous power he has within the Democratic Party right now. Tonight, as Democrats are hoping to take another shot at passing President Biden's agenda, Senator Joe Manchin remains a powerful force in deciding whether or not the legislation actually moves forward. Our Brian Todd is taking a closer look at Senator Manchin and his influence. Brian, the very interesting, the West Virginia Democrat has put himself right in the center of this political battle.
He certainly has, Wolf. You know, after about a decade when, frankly, he didn't make a lot of headlines as a senator, Joe Manchin is seen tonight as one of the most powerful people in Washington, at least for the moment.
Hey, Joe!
On a recent sunny morning along the waterfront in Washington, protesters in boats showed up at Senator Joe Manchin's houseboat, the Almost Heaven. They baited him to come out, and when he did, they gave him an earful.
We love West Virginia, and we believe in our state. We need you to stand with us.
The protesters were upset that Manchin, possibly the most conservative Democrat in the Senate, was holding up passage of President Biden's domestic agenda package. Senator Manchin came to the deck, engaged the protesters for several minutes, even gave out his office number and his scheduler's name, and invited them to Capitol Hill.
Tom, come up to the office. Come up to the office. You're more than welcome.
Observers say that's Joe Manchin in a nutshell, fiercely independent, often stubborn, but in the end, likable.
There's no president going to tell me how to vote.
What no one doubts at the moment is the enormous leverage the 6'3", 74-year-old descendant of Italian and Czechoslovak immigrants currently wields in the nation's capital.
Manchin is certainly powerful. He's arguably one of the most powerful people in D.C. right now.
That's because Manchin and fellow Democrat Kyrsten Sinema are the lone Democratic holdouts to passing Biden's bill. Manchin is pushing back against the overall spending number, wants to pare down the Medicare expansion and paid family leave portions of the bill, and is against some of the clean energy provisions that might harm the coal industry in his home state of West Virginia.
Where I'm reaching out to everybody I can on both sides of the aisle, talking to them, they know exactly where I stand. The problem is we're divided.
How much of a pain in the neck has Manchin been to Biden and the progressives in this process?
There have been sources in the White House and other Democratic sources that are very frustrated by how long the process is taking.
Joe Manchin was born in a small coal mining town in West Virginia to a politically active family that owned carpet and furniture stores. He went to West Virginia University on a football scholarship, later ran a coal brokerage firm, served as West Virginia's governor for about 5 years, then ran successful Senate campaigns based on his message that a Democrat can connect with hardline red state voters.
And I'll take dead aim at the cap and trade bill.
But even as a conservative Democrat, how has Manchin managed to win in a state where Donald Trump destroyed his Democratic opponents in the last two presidential elections?
He's a very approachable guy, and West Virginia is a small state, and it depends heavily on retail politics, and he handles that role well.
Now, how will Manchin get through this maelstrom politically? Analysts say he should weather any possible primary challenge when he's up for re-election in 2024, but it might be a bit tough for him to win in the general election. Wolf, will be interesting in 3 years.
We'll see what happens. Brian Todd, thank you very, very much. I'll be back tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. Eastern, for CNN's special coverage of former Secretary of State Colin Powell's funeral at the National Cathedral here in Washington. I'll be reporting from the National Cathedral. Thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. Aaron Burnett Out Front starts right now.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.